From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Those seeking gender-affirming care in Florida now have even more hurdles to contend with.
We saw a ton of providers across the state shut down their clinics, stop providing any care to transgender minors particularly.
Also this week, both federal and state law enforcers agree human trafficking is horrible. What they don't agree about is how to handle the cases.
Under this administration, the new executive director has decided to stop forwarding those tips directly to law enforcement.
We'll also catch up on the dispute between state government officials and educators about what constitutes good pay for teachers, and we'll trace some of the reasons why Florida prices, especially home prices, keep zooming skyward. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. A federal judge has struck down a Florida law that banned doctors from providing gender-affirming care to most kids. It also created hurdles for adults to access care. Now, advocates say they hope more transgender patients will be able to get what they see as life-saving care, and we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Simone Chris is a lawyer on the case. She's also the director of the Transgender Initiative at Southern Legal Counsel. She says some of the providers who once offered gender-affirming care have had to close their doors.
Unfortunately, after SB 254 came out, we saw a ton of providers across the state shut down their clinics, stop providing any care to transgender minors particularly. I know a lot of APRNs and NPs have had to shift their practice and you know, treat other diagnoses and other patients because they were not allowed to treat trans patients.
The law blocked doctors from providing gender-affirming care to most kids and blocked any provider except doctors from prescribing things like hormone therapy to transgender adults, meaning nurse practitioners and physician's assistants couldn't offer that care. Chris says the ruling reverses that, but she thinks it will take a while for the care to catch up.
My hope is that as the news spreads about this, that all of the providers that had shut down or just stopped seeing trans patients because they were not allowed by law to treat them will resume that care so that everyone can resume seeing their trusted medical provider who prescribed them gender-affirming care prior to this.
Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis has spoken out against the ruling and says the state plans to appeal it.
We may win it very quickly, given that the 11th Circuit has already adjudicated this case going forward.
That case will go before an appeals court in Alabama, where the judges have previously overturned a stay on an Alabama law banning gender-affirming care for minors. But Chris says the court has also handed down a ruling that supported access to gender-affirming care, and she believes her group has a strong argument.
Even if they apply the standard that they applied in Eknis Tucker, the Alabama case, we still win because we proved conclusively at trial that these bans are based on animus and bias and a motivation to deter transgender people from being transgender as opposed to any legitimate justification or motive that the state could put forward.
Chris says it's not known at this point when the appeal could take place. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody is touting the takedown of a human trafficking ring by a new statewide strike force. As Margie Menzel reports, Moody blames the federal government for the prevalence of trafficking and is pushing Florida to be more aggressive.
Human trafficking is an atrocious crime.
Moody is known for her passionate opposition to human trafficking.
And certainly in the last few years with the wide open border and the lack of enforcement of the rule of law as it pertains to the border, this has been an even greater challenge.
On Thursday, Moody announced the bust of a trafficking ring in the Tampa Bay area and the rescue of 10 of its victims. She also announced the new Florida Human Trafficking Strike Team, which is helping local law enforcement already. Their latest arrest was Lena Payne, who is accused of recruiting women from South America with promises of jobs, then forcing them into sex work to pay off their travel debts, often under threats of violence. Florida has ranked among the states with the highest incidence of human trafficking for at least a decade, according to calls made to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. But Moody is unhappy with that hotline, and so she's established a state hotline that reports directly to Florida law enforcement. Moody is critical of Catherine Chen, who leads the national hotline under a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Unfortunately, within the last couple of years, under this administration, the new executive director has decided to stop forwarding those tips directly to law enforcement. And as you can imagine, in Florida, we work cooperatively with and support the efforts of the men and women of law enforcement.
The National Hotline has been in existence for 17 years and has served 75,000 victims and survivors on a 24/7 basis. According to Chen, they report about 30% of their cases to law enforcement. Those include all cases involving the abuse, neglect, or trafficking of a minor, which are reported to child welfare as well as to law enforcement, cases involving violence or the imminent threat of harm or death, if an adult victim of trafficking asks them to call, or if an adult victim asks someone else to call for them. Chen says the other 75% of their callers are usually seeking services and often call several times before they ask. And callers often don't want law enforcement involved. The reason hotline staff puts those decisions in the hands of callers
is the loss of power and autonomy. It's the loss of the ability to make your own decisions.
Chen says many victims are in relationships with their traffickers, even share children with them. And many traffickers know where the loved ones of their victims live and threaten to harm them.
What we are trying our best to do is to rebuild trust and to rebuild agency as fast as we can. And to help that person who knows what is the safest for them, right? Who knows all of the different dimensions of what they have to deal with, make the choices that are right for them.
Now Florida has a new state hotline, 855-FLA-SAFE, so that people can report directly to law enforcement. The Florida House of Representatives voted unanimously for the bill that created it, and Governor Ron DeSantis signed it into law last month. Actually, the function of reporting human trafficking was added to an already established hotline that also reports food stamp fraud and gasoline pump fraud. Moody urges the public to call in tips to law enforcement if they suspect trafficking, even if it's something they aren't sure is significant.
And they'll call and we can solve a cold case. Whether it's a change of consciousness or whether it's they have a feeling that maybe it's more than what they initially thought, call. It's not going to be any skin off our back to run it down.
Moody says with those tips, law enforcement agencies often can review reports of suspected trafficking and put plans in place to rescue victims. I'm Margie Menzel.
Grappling with issues of government power and academic freedom, a federal appeals court today heard arguments in a battle about a 2022 Florida law that restricts how race-related concepts can be taught in state universities. A law that Governor Ron DeSantis dubbed the Stop Woke Act. The state appealed after Chief U.S. District Judge Mark Walker, back in November of 2022, issued a preliminary injunction against the law, which he said violated First Amendment rights. Charles Cooper, an attorney for the state, told a three-judge panel of the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals during today's hearing the state has the authority to make choices about the content of university courses. Coming up on Capitol Report, despite claims that Florida's teachers are seeing big boosts in their pay, with more on the way, others are taking issue with that.
The governor probably should go back to math class, because he's doing some real fuzzy math here.
Oh, the challenges that face our special ed teachers, which explains the current shortage.
Collaborating with the colleagues in the classroom, collaborating with the students' parents, collaborating with their therapists, their whole teams.
Population changes in Florida are just one factor contributing to recent jumps in the cost of living for Floridians.
Our insurance rates in Monroe County are astronomical. And when you tack on windstorm insurance, flood insurance, and homeowners, many times that's more than your mortgage payment.
And while Florida's considered the nation's number one state for boating, it's also the number one state for boating accidents.
A lot of these folks are entry level and don't consider themselves voters, but they definitely are and can easily fall victim to drowning.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed this year's state budget, which includes about $200 million for teacher pay raises. However, school officials across Florida say that's not enough. Adrian Andrews spoke with a teacher who believes her salary should be higher because she's been in the profession for 15 years, yet can barely afford her bills.
Stephanie Yoakum is an algebra teacher and president of Polk County's teacher union. She's one of many Florida educators who believes the state is failing teachers when it comes to addressing their salaries. She says she can barely afford her rent or property insurance.
The state does give classroom teachers like teacher lead money, which is like $300 for supplies. So that gets you through like the first 9 weeks. The dollars that we negotiate are for salaries and benefits.
After increasing starting teacher pay in 2020 to just over $47,000, the Florida legislature allocated additional money in March to bring the state's total investment for teachers' salaries to over $1 billion. Governor Ron DeSantis recently approved that allocation.
One of the things that we've approved are the major investments in education and the major investments in raising teacher pay. And part of what we've done is we've provided bonuses. We've provided increased money for salaries.
Florida's new budget will total $116 billion. Of that, $200 million will go towards teacher pay raises. But teachers like Stephanie Yoakum aren't that impressed.
If you divide $200 million divided by about 200,000 teachers in the state, that's actually not a lot of money.
The Florida Education Association ran the numbers and said teachers could expect to see roughly $125 added to their paycheck. FEA President Andrew Spahr blasted DeSantis during a press conference for his, quote, fuzzy math. He says the governor and the Florida legislature should make better use of taxpayer money by investing more into things like teacher pay, student mental health programs, and school safety.
He doesn't even know what to do with those dollars. Imagine that. The governor doesn't even know what to do.
One school test coordinator in Osceola County made a statement about her salary during an interview with reporters. She told them despite having a master's degree and 23 years of teaching experience, she takes home about $55,000, which is only $6,000 more than what a starting educator makes in her county. WFSU asked Polk County's Yoakum what she believes the average teacher should make in Florida. She replied,
as teachers, minimum 75, and then it goes up from there.
Florida's Commissioner of Education, Manny Diaz, believes the Sunshine State is doing just fine in the education department. During the governor's budget signing, he listed a few of the state's accomplishments, highlighting Florida's recent push to stop critical race theory in classrooms and expanding school choice options for students.
We have removed dangerous and divisive rhetoric like critical race theory, diversity, equity, inclusion, and we have made tremendous investments like you heard today in teacher pay.
As pay remains a concern for teacher unions across Florida, FEA's Spahr wants lawmakers to set $2.5 billion aside for the next 7 years to, quote, put the state in the top 10 in the nation for teacher pay. That's a plan Polk County's Yoakum says she can get behind.
Public education is one of the pillars that makes our democracy strong. When we have an educated populace that has equal, equitable access to education, our society is stronger.
Florida currently ranks second to last in the nation for average teacher pay. According to the National Education Association, the Sunshine State sits right above Washington, D.C., which pays its teachers roughly $53,000. I'm Adrian Andrews.
More than 7 million K-12 students in the U.S. require special education. That means they have a physical, mental, or learning disability. In Florida, they make up 15% of students, but we don't have enough qualified teachers to serve them. To try to fix that, the University of Central Florida is offering free master's degrees paid for by the federal government. WLRN's Yvonne Zumtobel tells us more about Project Bridges.
We have 8 campuses across Central Florida. And every campus is a little bit.
Walkers and wheelchairs line the hallways of this K-8 charter school.
Traditional schools, they have one classroom just for special needs. We don't. We have one fifth grade class. Our kids learn together at the same time. They just may do it a little bit different.
Matthew Hardigan is community engagement manager at UCP Bailey's Community Academy in Orlando. UCP stands for Unlocking Children's Potential, and this is an inclusion school. Half of the students here have special needs.
We can go upstairs then. I'll make sure.
Hi, how are you? This is a recorder.
It's a microphone.
Yeah, I'm just recording our conversation.
Haley Thrift and I are sitting together in kid-sized desks, observing her class of third and fourth graders.
I actually found my passion for working with individuals with special needs when I was in middle school. When I was in middle school, I took a elective course called Future Teachers, and I was placed in the school's autism unit. And from there, I just fell in love with working with individuals with special needs.
Wednesday. Today is Wednesday. Yes, Bob. Here you go.
Thrift is a recent graduate of the University of Central Florida's Project Bridges, a federally funded program that aims at fighting the shortage of special education teachers. There are 9 students here, and Thrift is joined by an occupational therapist and a speech therapist. She tells me why it's important that these kids get extra attention.
So there is still a need for our kiddos who have that higher intensity needs and behavioral needs to come into a smaller classroom so that they can get their curriculum goals, their behavior, their social emotional goals met in a smaller environment. They come to me for the core academics from 9 to 12:15, and then they go back to their inclusion classrooms. So they still get that social emotional aspect with their typical gen ed peers.
Thrift has been teaching here for 3 years. While working full-time, she earned her master's in exceptional student education, taking classes at night. It was paid for by the U.S. Department of Education. As a recipient of this scholarship, Thrift has to fulfill a service obligation. That means she must teach students with disabilities for the next 4 years. Earning a master's degree didn't give Thrift a huge jump in her salary, only 4%, from $50,500 to $52,500. Her biggest takeaway was learning to collaborate.
Collaborating with the colleagues in the classroom, collaborating with the students' parents, collaborating with their therapist, their whole team, some speech pathologists, some physical therapists, occupational therapists. It can be a big team.
A little boy comes up to us with what looks like an iPad.
Hi.
What does this do?
This is his AAC device, which is an augmentative means of, yeah, then Nicholas is your best friend. So he doesn't speak orally. He speaks through his device.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah. He's able to kind of just recognize the pictures and know.
Yes. So he works with our speech language pathologists on how to, on how to use it, because it is a lot. It's a lot of information.
According to the Florida Department of Education, during the 2022-2023 school year, nearly 16% of courses for students with disabilities were taught by teachers not certified in that field. The U.S. Department of Education has been funding professional development programs like these across the country since 2006. Federal data show more than 90% of recent scholarship recipients are working in their field until they've met their service obligation. That's either 2 or 4 years later, depending on the student. Thrift feels like the master's degree really leveled up her skills.
It changed my life for the better, and it changed my life in this field. It's made a huge impact on my students and the way that I teach, so it's definitely worthwhile.
Since 2015, 56 special education students have graduated from UCF's Project Bridges. Projections show that for the upcoming school year, there will be more than 2,500 vacancies for ESE teachers in Florida. I'm Yvonne Zumtobel in Orlando.
Housing, insurance, and health care are among the forces driving population shifts around Florida. In this report, Tom Hudson has a tale of two cities in South Florida, one growing, one losing population, and both dealing with the challenge of high home prices.
About 200 miles separate Key West and Parkland.
One dates back centuries. The other is barely 50 years old. One holds itself up to be the model of modern suburban living. The other has, shall we say, a different reputation.
I'm Terry Johnston, mayor of the city of Key West.
Yeah, my name is Richard Walker, and I'm the mayor for the city of Parkland.
These two cities are on different ends of the spectrum of Florida's relentless population growth. Parkland is the fastest growing city in South Florida since the COVID-19 pandemic. Its population has increased more than 9%.
To be honest, that's very exciting. It tells you that Parkland is a desirable city for people to move to.
Key West is at the other end. It experienced the sharpest drop in residents, losing 5% of its population.
You know what? It makes sense.
Even though one is growing and one is shrinking, the two cities share some of the same driving forces behind their population changes, housing supply and home prices. Terry Johnston describes her city of Key West as a 2x4 mile neighborhood.
Our neighborhoods and the fabric of Key West are being eroded by the nightly rentals, Airbnbs, things of that nature. And that's what concerns me.
While Key West is a vacation destination and is hemmed in on all sides by water, Parkland has been adding areas, such as one known as The Wedge. It includes 5 single-family home developments, including one that is 55-plus.
We have a lot of people who took advantage of the higher prices, and maybe they were empty nesters and they decided to move. That makes housing available for younger families that have children. For us, one of the things that's important, the schools, great parks, we have great amenities.
More homes are coming. The city bought part of the old Heron Bay Golf Course about a year and a half ago. Then it sold almost 24 acres to a home builder. But these won't be starter homes, they'll be luxury homes. And the area is expected to include some commercial development like shopping and restaurants.
We bought that to kind of limit how much residential we can have in there. It also gives us an opportunity to provide additional amenities to our residents. We don't have a lot of shopping, restaurants, and now we're going to have that center hub in our city.
And Parkland's mayor says they have their eyes on the largest undeveloped tract of land in Broward County, hundreds of acres that sits between Parkland's northwest border and Loxahatchee Road.
We will have additional supply, but whether it's 3 years, 4 years, 10 years from now, we don't really know that.
In Key West, Johnston hopes to address their lack of housing supply by asking voters to change the city charter, allowing it to buy property for affordable housing. Currently, the city can only buy property if voters okay the purchase through a ballot referendum.
You know, if we want our employees to stay here and live here in the city of Key West, raise their families here, send their kids to our schools, then we've got to do something to impact that. And that falls into the category housing.
Adding to the cost of housing is insurance, regardless if it's Key West or Parkland.
Yeah, insurance costs, it's out of the control of local government.
Yeah, Florida homeowners already pay the highest premium for home insurance. One new analysis puts the average home insurance rate in Florida close to $11,000 a year. Key West has the additional challenge that the taxpayer-backed Citizens Property Insurance, the insurer of last resort, often is the only insurer.
Our insurance rates in Monroe County are astronomical. And when you tack on windstorm insurance, flood insurance, and homeowners, many times that's more than your mortgage payment. That takes our young families out of eligibility to own in the city of Key West.
Key West is in good company of South Florida cities shrinking since the pandemic. Others with high housing costs saw a drop in population. Miami Beach and Aventura lost about 4% of their residents. Sunny Isles Beach and Coral Gables shrunk by about 2% each. Healthcare is another challenge for keeping residents at the end of the Overseas Highway. The only cancer treatment center in the Keys closed last summer.
There's just some services that we've not been able to sustain in the city of Key West because of housing, because of qualified labor force in order to support that entity. We're really struggling in those areas.
Meantime, the populations of communities at the other end of South Florida, like Parkland, are growing. West Palm Beach and Plantation grew by about 5% each. Doral is the fastest growing city in Miami-Dade County, adding about 4.5% more people since the pandemic. And the city of Miami, the largest city in the region, added 3% more people. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
Florida's citrus industry is nearing the end of the 2023-2024 growing season, showing relatively little growth from the previous Hurricane Marge season. The U.S. Department of Agriculture this week released a monthly forecast that showed a slight uptick from May projections for the state's orange crop, but the forecast for grapefruit and specialty fruits dipped from May projections. The forecast for the overall citrus harvest is about 11% higher than the 2022-2023 yield, but last year's total was the lowest in more than nine decades. Wednesday's numbers are more than 50% lower than production during the 2021-2022 season, before Hurricane Ian caused widespread damage to groves. Florida Citrus Mutual CEO Matt Joyner says the forecast, with the increased projection for oranges, gives growers renewed hope that the industry will overcome the ongoing challenges.
We knew that we would be up boxes this season, and that continues to be the case, but we also knew that this is going to be a long recovery after multiple hurricanes. We've lost a fair amount of acreage as a result of that.
In addition to hurricane damage, the industry has faced problems such as a deadly disease known as citrus greening. The monthly forecast was released as Governor Ron DeSantis signed a state budget for the 2024-2025 fiscal year that includes more than $47 million for the citrus industry. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the annual tally of boating accidents throughout Florida has just been released. WGCU senior environmental reporter Tom Bayless dug through the data, and here's what he found.
Florida leads the nation in boating accidents. Here's Captain Rachel Bryant, head of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Boating Safety Unit.
What we see and continue to see year after year is that the leading cause of death in boating accidents is drowning. We know life jackets save lives, and the FWC would like to encourage everyone in a vessel to wear a life jacket or a personal flotation device, regardless of age.
Boating statistics paint a picture of a deadly boating incident in Florida in 2023. It would have gone something like this. No life jackets were being worn on a boat cruising upriver on a summer evening. The captain, a sober, middle-aged man with no formal boater education, crashed the vessel into an immovable object, a pier, a rock jetty, or seawall. The person killed was thrown from the vessel in the crash. Not wearing a life jacket, he drowned. The FWC's officers patrol woods and water and compile statistics behind every boating accident and death every year. Trending in the 2023 report are those in paddle crafts, like canoes or paddle boards, that have hundreds of thousands of enthusiasts on the water, standing up on a surfboard and rowing.
A lot of these folks are entry level and don't consider themselves boaters, but they definitely are and can easily fall victim to drowning by falling overboard, falling out of the canoe, or simply falling off their paddleboard.
Paddleboarders are among the most exposed of boaters and much more likely to fall in from the waves from another boat's wake or even a stiff breeze. Without a life jacket, Brian said, a paddleboarder's simple mishap is putting some of them on the pages of next year's Boating Accidents Report. In Fort Myers, I'm Tom Bayless.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tom Hudson, Yvonne Zumtobel, and Tom Bayless. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.